Good evening. Good evening. Come on, act like it's a beautiful spring evening. My name is Jonathan L. Walton, and I am the Plummer Professor of Christian Morals and Pusey Minister here in the Memorial Church of Harvard University. And I would like to welcome all of you to the 2016 William Belden Noble Lecture. This annual lecture was established in 1898 by Nanny Eulie Noble in memory of her husband, William Belden Noble, who was a student at Harvard Divinity School who passed away untimely while preparing for a career in ministry. Since that time, Harvard has welcomed some of the leading intellectuals to expound on major themes of faith and public life. Past Noble lecturers have included Theodore Roosevelt in 1911, Harvey Cox in 1968, author Kathleen Norris in 2001, and documentary filmmaker Stanley Nelson just last year in 2015. And it is within this grand intellectual tradition that we are so honored and privileged to present to you tonight novelist, theologian, cultural critic, and spiritual sage, Marilynne Robinson. Now, before we formally introduce our lecturer tonight, let me just say a few words about the space in which you currently sit. The Memorial Church of Harvard was dedicated on Armistice Day in 1932 as a war memorial to honor Harvard men and Radcliffe women who lost their lives in World War I. Their names were indelibly etched on the walls of the adjacent memorial room so that we will never forget those young voices that were hushed too soon. Unfortunately, the so-called war to end all wars was anything but. And through World War II, Korea, and Vietnam, we continue to add more names of lives lost too soon. Yet more than a place of solemn remembrance, we have also served as a practicing faith community for the past 84 years at the center of Harvard Yard, praying for a world where we won't have to study war no more. And praying for a war and for a world that the weapons of love will enable our faith to overcome our fears. Thus, every Sunday morning, we are here as a multi-denominational Protestant community. So we are a war memorial. We are a worshiping community. Yet even more than that, beyond a place of worship on Sunday, we are a laboratory of learning, a site of human connection, and a space of critical inquiry 7 days a week. This is why you are here tonight, because our mission at the Memorial Church is to educate minds, to expand hearts, and thus enrich lives. Now, at this time, I would like to bring up the person who will introduce our lecturer. It is in the person of Professor Matthew Potts. Professor Potts is an assistant professor of ministry studies at Harvard Divinity School. He joined the faculty of Harvard in 2013 after completing his doctoral degree right here on this campus. Professor Potts specializes in religion and literature, and he is the author of the recently published book, Cormac McCarthy and the Signs of the Sacrament, Literature, Theology, and Moral Stories. Please welcome Professor Potts at this time.
Thank you, Professor. Thank you all for being here tonight. It really is my honor and my privilege to introduce to you the F. Wendell Miller Professor of English and Creative Writing at the University of Iowa, Marilyn Robinson, as our Nobel lecturer this evening. Professor Robinson started her studies at Pembroke College in Providence and took her PhD at the University of Washington, where she wrote about Shakespeare. She's taught widely here in our Commonwealth at Amherst College and the University of Massachusetts, but most famously, and for several years now, at the University of Iowa. Her teaching has not been limited to her institutional affiliations, though. She's lectured widely at Yale and Oxford and other places, and of course, also now here at Harvard. Were I to list all the institutions from which she has won honorary degrees, I would overstay my welcome. She was awarded the National Humanities Medal by President Obama in 2012. She's won the Pulitzer Prize, the Orange Prize, the National Books Critics Circle Award, the Grevemeyer Award, which is a very important award in our field of the study of religion, and many, many nominations and shortlistings for other international and national prizes. But honestly, you could have read all of that on your magic phones, right, in the time it took me to tell you that. So I want to introduce her in a couple of different ways. First, I want to tell you about, actually, I just met Professor Robinson now, so I actually want to tell you about a couple of people who know her and who I have met, right? And then talk to you a bit more about why Professor Robinson is such an important voice in the literary world and in the critical conversation of our world. So a couple of years ago, here at Harvard, Rowan Williams came to speak. Rowan Williams was the 104th Archbishop of Canterbury, and he gave the Tanner Lectures here at Harvard. And I'm an Episcopal priest and a great admirer of Rowan Williams. I think he's a magnificent thinker and a very erudite and a careful scholar. And so when he came for these lectures, I wanted to meet him and have him sign a book and all this stuff. And I went up to talk to him after his lecture. And we only spoke for a few minutes. And I'll tell you, within the first 15 seconds, we were talking about Marilyn Robinson. And to be clear, his lecture was not on Marilyn Robinson. It's just what was on his mind at the moment that I walked up. And he spoke about, I guess, that he had invited Professor Robinson to come to Cambridge, the other Cambridge, where he is now Master of Magdalen College. He invited her to come, and she had done some things there, I guess, that I don't remember all the details, frankly, but he just said that he was humbled to be in her presence because of the great power of her mind and her talent. And he said that he thought that there was no more important literary voice from America. And then the other person I know who had knew Marilyn Robinson, or who I met, I guess, I don't really know Rowan Williams, right, but who I met, who knows Professor Robinson, is a classmate of mine, actually, from here at Harvard. I started studies in ministry here 11 years ago, and one of my classmates is a man named Chris Adrian. And Chris studied at the Iowa Writers' Workshop. And Chris did an MDiv here. He's also a pediatric oncologist and a fine novelist in his own right. Now he's on the faculty at Columbia University Medical School. And he's an atheist, or at least he says he's an atheist. And I saw him interviewed after he studied here, and the interviewer asked him, why, you know, you're a pediatric oncologist and a novelist, why did you want to study ministry at Harvard? And he said, because I wanted Marilyn Robinson to like me. So here are two very, at least outwardly, by outward appearances, two very different people, right? We have this elder churchman, this learned, you know, sort of Oxford, Cambridge scholar, theologian, and then a pediatric oncologist, another brilliant mind who writes novels and atheist. And both of these people say that Professor Robinson's voice is indispensable to our world. Both of them want Marilyn Robinson to like them. They could explain better why they feel that, but I'm going to tell you, since they're not here to tell you, I'm going to tell you why I think she is indispensable to our world. What stands out to me about Professor Robinson's work, in brief, is her capacity to reveal mysteries. And I don't mean that necessarily in some mystical sense, that word mystery, although I'm not limiting it necessarily either. I just mean that in both her fiction and in her essays, Professor Robinson has a profound knack for taking what is familiar, for taking what we think we already know, and then making it strange, revealing its mysteries. That is, she observes familiar persons or common events or assumed ideas, and she asks us to look at them long enough and patiently enough and attentively enough and even lovingly enough to reveal how complex and rich and beautiful those things in fact are. In short, she causes us to wonder at these familiar people and ideas and things. And in doing so, she causes us to keep reading. This is true in her essays, her latest collection, The Givenness of Things, being perhaps the most dramatic, if not only the most recent example, where we're allowed to see things in all these essays that we think we know, like Puritanism or liberalism or modernism or Darwinism. We see these things anew. But it's also the depth and the breadth of her readings in these essays, which are distilled in these 10 or 12 page insights. She has an essay on Bonhoeffer in The Death of Adam that could reasonably replace a really great seminar I took on Bonhoeffer here. It was a great seminar. I'm not talking about the seminar, but it's a wonderful, wonderful essay. In her first novel, Housekeeping, the familiarity of estrangement and loss is rendered in prose that attends so patiently and deliberately to the pains and peculiarities of a small town childhood that it also lends these common lives and everyday losses an almost biblical, even mystical, heft. And we see this surely too in the Gilead novels, the interconnected trio of novels, Gilead, Home, and Lila, in the lives of these familiar and now well-beloved characters. We see how intricately history and religion and race and theology and modernity fold in upon each other in the lives of so-called ordinary people in a so-called ordinary town in the Middle West of mid-century America in ways that we often, I think, or I often tend to overlook. But also how these repeated visits to Gilead cause us to see these people in new ways, through new eyes, how these books and these characters speak to and through each other. You know, you finish Gilead, and you could not imagine a more fully realized fictional character than John Ames. And then Professor Robinson keeps writing, and we keep reading. This is surely part of the brilliance of these books, I think, their revisiting of these characters and events, not to undermine truth or to undermine truth's meaningfulness, sort of Rashomon style, but to lay bare truth's layered complexities, to show the almost limitless capacity of meaningful things to be seen again, to be seen anew, brought to relevance in living and interesting and important ways. So when I say that Professor Robinson reveals mysteries, I don't mean that she dispels them. I mean that she reveals them as mysterious. She shows us that things are never as simple as they seem. And then she lays forth all the lovely and intricate and sometimes tragically beautiful complexities. Whether it's John the Evangelist, John Calvin, John Falstaff, John Ames, she makes these familiar figures into strangers. But faithful Christian that she is, she immediately welcomes these strangers and asks us to do the same. As soon as they are made into these strangers, she calls us, too, to take them in and treat them with kindness and respect. She invites us to be forgiving and hospitable and honest towards them, to be charitable, to be attentive, to be good, to be honest, to be true, to take them seriously. Which may mean at times noticing their flaws and their foibles, but when we do notice those things, we do so with gentleness and understanding, rather than dismissal. Were we too easily or hastily overlook, she asks us to look again. She calls us to marvel again at all the possibilities of any meaningful truth, indeed to marvel that it is perhaps the very nature of meaningful truth to be so full of possibility. And in this sense, I believe Professor Robinson is a profoundly moral writer, as well as a beautifully religious writer, in any good sense of that word, too. As you might expect, Professor Robinson has said all this better than I ever could already, when she has the Reverend John Ames conclude his long testimony in Gilead, saying, "Wherever you turn your eyes, the world can shine like transfiguration. You don't have to bring a thing to it except the willingness to see. Only who could have the courage to see it?" Professor Robinson, for one, has that courage, or at least the willingness to attempt such courage, which is probably the same thing. And in her writing, she lends that courage also to us, which is why we are her faithful and grateful readers. So this is why we are so honored to have her here in Cambridge, this Cambridge, here at Harvard, here at the Memorial Church tonight. It's all of those reasons, but it's also just because, as everyone here already knows, Marilynne Robinson can write an English sentence just about as well as anyone now living on planet Earth. And that in itself would be reason enough for me to step aside and let her speak, and so I will. Please, Mrs. Robinson.
So you could see me. I want to point out, first of all, that I have a larger and more glorious bird than Bernie Sanders did. So it's wonderful. It's a great honor, a great pleasure to be here. And thank you all for your kindness. Thank you for a very kind introductions. Something that I have done for a long time is think about where ideas come from, where our assumptions come from, and wonder about the appropriateness of our continuing to accept them as assumptions. What I'm going to be talking about tonight is the way that the idea of myth in an invidious sense has sort of embarrassed a great part of Christianity away from its own metaphysics, I know I will argue, and when I argue, you will know that I think that we have reduced in a way the scale of human experience, and this is something that I talk about a great deal. But I think that this anxiety about the fact that our religion in many ways resembles other religions, whether ancient or other, you know, and contemporary, but other. And that it's wrong, it's an error of the 19th century thinking to imagine that we have to pass invidious judgments on things because they are either ancient or come from another thought world. One of the things that I know teaching the Bible, which I do at the Writer's Workshop, writers want to know that document, you know, is that the students seem often to have been instructed in considering ancient as a synonym for primitive. And so there's a kind of built-in condescension toward whatever we identify, you know, with paganism, whatever, however they might admire it in the museum and so on. It's considered a sort of embarrassment of Judeo-Christianity that it has things in common with these other ways of thinking, which it seems to me is an obvious error, and one that is certainly peculiar to a time in Western thought where Western thought was not going well, by which I mean European thought from the middle of the 19th century until the middle of the 20th century, a long time, and a very authoritative period. So, in any case, I will begin talking about the divine. I've already said a lot of these things, but I will say them again. When words drop out of use, meanings go with them, perhaps. When the sense of the significant changes, language changes, or so it seems, it has been characteristic of the modern West for generations to try to move away from a vocabulary that is charged with its own intellectual and cultural history, the shift being understood as advancing thought from the pre-scientific to the scientific, or from the religious to the secular, these two motives being more or less interchangeable. There's nothing especially novel in this. Quakers noticed that the days and months were named for pagan gods and dignitaries, and so they numbered them instead, first day, second day. The French Revolution reset the calendar to the year one and renamed the months, Germinal, Floréal, but the pretty names could not be made to adhere, or the Quaker numbers either. So Janus still stands at the opening of the year, Mars still brings his tempests, the emperors Julius and Augustus still lord it through our high summer. Sun and moon, Woden, Thor, and Saturn still name our days. Language changes and language conserves itself. We human beings are the language makers, of course, but efforts like these to change, to change it respond to an awareness that in very important ways language creates us. At best, we try to oppress demeaning words because they are powerful. They affect the ways in which people are perceived and also the perceptions that they have of themselves. It seems that we have in this country at this time an experience of disempowerment of a significant part of the population, and that the old despotisms of disparagement and abuse are reasserting their claims because they have retained the power of old injustice, no matter how far society may have moved in a better direction. Words can be very crude weapons that are always ready to hand. I mention this to make the point that, as present experience illustrates with painful clarity, we are profoundly enmeshed in language. Slurs have their power because we all acknowledge the kind of meaning they have in the very fact of our recoiling from their use, so they live on. What has crude, assaultive language to do with the odd assortment of pagans and pagan deities whose names, after millennia, haunt our calendar? What have either of these to do with the fact that there are words and concepts that do indeed fade out of use, despite the fact that we might sometimes feel the lack of them? Language is a universe. Its elements are truly various, given, to use a favorite word of mine. They act eccentrically in time. They elude generalization. I've been thinking about the phrase, the divine. I cannot remember the last time I heard it in the context of religion. It is not synonymous with the sacred or the holy, certainly not with the spiritual. It is different from all these in that it refers directly to God, or in the Latin of pagan antiquity, to a god. If we suppose that it has become rare because our vision of ultimate reality no longer centers on a divine being, this is an epical change, certainly. We in the West tend to imagine that changes in our thinking are advances of some kind, or are at least made inevitable in consequence of cultural or material evolution. In the most horrifying period of recent Western history, where Europe might well have been entering a new dark age, Dietrich Bonhoeffer wrote that his was a world come of age, which must be offered a religionless Christianity. I take him to have meant, or at least to have been exploring the idea, that for Christianity to survive in modern culture, it must be relieved of its burden of ritual and myth. Bonhoeffer was a brilliant writer and an exemplary man, but it is difficult to understand how he could have seen collective maturity in a civilization then giving itself over to myths and cults of an imagined primitivity and to the active rehabilitation of Norse barbarism. In any case, this interpretation of modern culture as qualitatively changed by a new maturity outlasted the bizarre mutations which might seem to have challenged it, and will outlast them again, no doubt, since we have no reason at all to assume that they will not reemerge in one form or another, or are not reemerging now. If the West has an enduring faith in any one idea, it is that the West advances, that is to say, that it matures in the direction of enlightenment, with all this entails in terms of the loss of illusion and the rejection of error. We stigmatize what we feel we must reject, and this discourages a reappraisal. If, as we do this, We build the thinking of an earlier period into our understanding of the world, when by the logic of our assumptions, we should be scrupulously aware of the potential for error in conclusions drawn 50 or 100 years ago, as of those drawn 1,000 years ago. The error of the long modern period might seem subtler to our eye than those of earlier centuries, but there is no reason to assume that they are less consequential. What is myth, after all? It is narrative that conveys a kind of truth by non-literal means. This is a definition meant to exclude the influence of a common second sense of the word that myth is unreal, untrue. Setting this aside for the moment, I will suggest that the primary meaning of the word myth, as it has been applied to Christianity, would be those elements of the religion that it has in common with other religions. The ascendant West was ill at ease with the resemblance of its religion to non-Western religions. In its likeness to them, Christianity must be primitive. Therefore, these elements were to be eliminated to conform Christianity to the worldview of a mature civilization. If myth or mythos were really thought of as a higher, more complex articulation of truth that is in principle available to being restated in other terms, then there is nothing about it to embarrass or offend the rational mind. If it is the truth it proposes that is rejected, this is another issue entirely in which myth as such is not implicated. Rather, the religion itself is tacitly called into question. The divine, divinitas, is a concept for which pagan Rome had a word Christianity could adopt without modification. To speak of the divinity of Christ has always meant not that he was sacred or holy or a spiritual man, though these things were true of him, but that he uniquely participated in the nature of God altogether, that he was God. And that he is God, since this is not the kind of statement that admits of a true past tense. The incarnation, the Trinity, these are names for things in which divinity, as Christianity has long understood it, is expressed and very tentatively described. It should not scandalize us people of the third millennium when language that reaches toward the essentially true departs from the standards of comprehensibility we would apply to experience, acknowledging, of course, that our experience is a brilliant translation of the infinite and volatile complexities of being itself into a world and universe that remarkably or providentially seem to lie within our grasp. Science before the 20th century supported the assumption that reason was, as the physicists say, flat. That like the laws of nature, its rules were the same everywhere and in all circumstances, and that whatever they could not countenance was an error, a primitive survival, a mystification. Then along came quantum physics, relativity, a theory of cosmic origins, and science ever since has been continuously at work at a new poetry, trying to capture something of this startling elegance, novel to our eyes, that eventuates in everything that is. Crucially assisted by dark matter, of course, which seems to hold the heavens together, and about which little else can be at present said. Only grant that a great creating holiness is at the center of it all, and one must arrive at something like the extraordinary language in which the ancients invested their perceptions. For the ancients, the great creative holiness was the intuition, the conception, that forced their language so far beyond the limits of the commonplace. Science departed from its origins in religion not so very long ago. If these two great thought systems are not now once again reaching a place of convergence, the fault lies with religion, which in a fit of defensive panic has abandoned its profoundest insights and has never reclaimed them. In the book of Acts, Paul, speaking to the Athenians, quotes one of their own poets, perhaps Epimenides, in invoking the God in whom we live and move and have our being. He recognized that behind all the idolatry, there was a metaphysics. Christianity, as it spread into the world, seems to have assumed this. It adopts the generic word God. It adopts the generic word for God in the pagan languages, Deus in Latin, God or Gott in Germanic Northern Europe. Whatever error might be liable to come with the use of a word associated for many centuries with Venus or Neptune, Thor or Woden, this did not weigh against a consensus about the reality of the divine across these very different cultures. There's a precedent for this in the Bible itself. The first verse of Genesis reads, "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth." The word God translates very precisely the Hebrew Elohim, a plural form of a generic word for God or gods, angels or powers, in the Semitic languages of the ancient Near East. The name given to Moses at the burning bush, the Tetragrammaton, modifies Elohim in the second creation narrative, but in the first, the word appears without modifier. A respectful reading might see this as reflecting an understanding of the emergence of being as the act of a divine power whose reality is a human intuition as broadly shared as the affinity of languages will allow the text to express. El is the name of the god at the head of the Canaanite pantheon. The god of the Bible is called El in some poetic passages. Many scholars see this as evidence of syncretism or of a polytheism lurking behind the declared monotheism of the Hebrew Bible. But the analogy to our own use of the word should suggest otherwise. The controversy between science and religion comes down to a familiar question. I should say between atheism and religion. I love science. The controversy between atheism and religion comes down to a familiar question. Is there a God? That is there an intentional power expressed in the existence of things? If the character of this power were to be modified by the name and the traditions surrounding any particular deity, this would not change either the question or the answer, nor would the metaphysical implications of the answer be fundamentally different either way. If Babylonian Marduk is at the center of being, heavens and earth are to be thought of as made from the corpse of a great serpent, and humankind are an afterthought tolerated for their usefulness in building temples and offering sacrifices. If the god the callers call Yahweh is at the center, his creation is good, humankind bear his image, and are the objects of deep attention and care. These are great differences with profound implications, yet secondary in significance to that more basic question, whether there is a God, whether reality in itself is or is not of a kind to require an affirmative answer. I do not mean to imply that any sufficient proof can ever be adduced on one side or the other of the question, only that one or the other must be true and must always have been true. Many of the religious among us have abandoned the divine as a concept, attempting to find a compromise position which in the nature of the case doesn't exist. Anthropologists can speak as fluently as theologians of the sacred or the holy or the spiritual, taking them to be an artifact of culture, if nothing else. For these scholars, patterns of behavior are sufficient proof that the terms are appropriate. The divine, by comparison, is a phrase that asserts the existence of a god or gods, that is, of a mode of being not conjured from human fear or hope, but prior to and independent of humankind, and profoundly efficacious, to be understood by tentative analogy to human consciousness, which it utterly transcends. The divine is understood to confer sanctity. It is acknowledged in the authority of the sacred, but cannot be, so to speak, captured by it. All the temples of Zeus and all the statues of him were not to be taken for Zeus himself. Say that this understanding of the divine was very broadly shared in the ancient world. Are these grounds for treating it as myth in any invidious sense? The modern West passed through its period of triumphalism, which has not ended yet, relegating all that was not modern or Western to the status of error, however pretty or interesting it might be in particular instances. Through most of this period, till well into the 20th century, science rejected what much of antiquity knew, which is that the universe had a beginning. The Egyptians, the Babylonians, the Greeks in Hesiod's Theogony, and the ancient Hebrews each tell the tale very differently, which suggests that it arose not from mutual influence, but from the independent intuition of an original act or moment somehow still palpable after billions of years that had already passed before the ancients began their speculations. These ancestors are not at all remote from us in cosmic time, of course, and the physical world we see, if we wander a little distance from its pavements and enclosures, is for all purposes the same world. We reasoned ourselves away from the perception of it as emergent, at the same time that we began to think of our own ancient text as mythic in a pejorative sense. Our best minds knew less about reality than Moses could have told them. This tendency toward dismissiveness persists. It seized the rhetorical high ground, perhaps 200 years ago, and has never relinquished it. The anxiety it inspires in some quarters has yielded a literalism that is brutally disrespectful of the text. Among non-literalists, it has produced an evasiveness that shies away from the text and from theological tradition as well. In many cases, what is intended as resistance to literalism tacitly concedes the legitimacy of literalism because sophisticated assumptions about the ancient and the mythic make reductionist readings seem inevitable. The new atheists, claiming the authority of science, go on about the old man with a white beard seated on a cloud, or they chuckle and scold at the thought of an imaginary friend. The response among the pious has been in some cases to put Adam on a dinosaur, proposing a science of their own. There's little to choose between the two. In both cases, there is a radical rejection of the language of the sublime, that is, of the divine. In neither case is there any conception of the beautiful. Say what one will about religion through the millennia, it has yielded a great bounty of art in every kind. When King Solomon set about building the great temple in Jerusalem where the Lord would put his name, he brought in foreign craftsmen who built something very like the temples of their own gods. Presumably to the eye of Solomon and all Israel, in its sacred architecture, pagan culture could and did make holiness and sublimity of a kind, did evoke holiness and sublimity of a kind appropriate to the temple of the God of Israel. This is the kind of thing that is regularly seen as evidence of syncretism and interpreted as evidence that the whole of the religion of Israel comes together piecemeal from surrounding influences. There is an impulse to debunk in academic writing that is so long established as to be unconscious in many instances. The impulse is only more persistent because it is now taken to be the tone and substance of disinterested scholarship. A correction against the biases of traditional piety, which need not concern itself with biases of its own. And the fact is that Israel lived in a swarming world surrounded by cultural kindred absorbed in their own rituals and myths. They lived in history like any other people. But every argument for syncretism can also be taken as evidence that Israel saw a true sense of the sacred in the surrounding cultures, not in the particulars of their beliefs and practices, but in the more primary fact that they had an intuition of the divine that did indeed bear some analogy to Israel's. In his epistle to the Romans, Paul says this about pagans and their religions: "What can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. Ever since the creation of the world, his invisible nature, namely his eternal power and deity, has been clearly perceived in the things that have been made. So they are without excuse, for although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking and their senseless minds were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man or birds or animals or reptiles. God has shown himself to mankind, end of quote, this is me, not Paul. God has shown himself to mankind plainly in his creation. The pagans know God, but their knowledge of him is warped and distracted by idolatry, worship of the creature rather than the creator. So the main point is established clearly here, that behind all the passionate differences and all the polemics, there is, in however fragmentary form, a shared and true perception of the divine. Time forbids the citing of numerous texts to the same effect to be found in the Hebrew Bible, a natural consequence of its monotheism. The Athenians ask Paul to tell them something new, and he responds by telling them something timeless. He says, God himself gives to all men life and breath and everything. And he quotes from another Greek poet, Aratus, who says of God, for we are indeed his offspring. Seen in this light, the similarities between Israelite and other religions would seem unembarrassed. A recognition and acknowledgement, not proof of cultural or textual pilfering. Above all, there should be no disparagement of implied claims of the religion of Abraham and Moses to immediate and original knowledge of God, when all knowledge of God, insofar as it retains some character of truth, must be immediate and original. God has shown it to humankind in the things that have been made. Let us say that there are grounds for speaking of the divine as mythic. It structures and characterizes reality in the way of myth. It asserts the existence of a being or beings aloof from time, who bears some likeness to humankind. It implants concepts like virtue and transgression so deeply in reality that reality responds to them as part of its own fabric. It is like myth in that it has scale. It refers to duration no human will ever experience. It refers to eternity, thinking past the extreme finitude of birth and death. And it considers the heavens. God only knows what night looked like when the last lamp went out in Babylon or Jerusalem or in Calvin's mountainous Geneva, and the great host of stars, innumerable as the sands of the sea, claimed its place in the firmament. On one hand, since Galileo have worked with passionate diligence to understand and observe the heavens and what a sight they are, we have looked into Melvillian nurseries and glimpsed the births of stars that came into being many millions of years ago, an odd privilege of our relation to space and time. We do these things that are unimaginable realizations of antiquity's old longing, and there is scarcely a poem or a prayer by way of celebration. It moves us not. Great God, I'd rather be a pagan. That's Wordsworth, of course. Who need not have wished for more than to be a Christian or a Jew in a place and time where the revelatory character of creation was acknowledged. But he is right, all in all. In the absence of divinity, it is the absence of divinity that dehumanizes nature. There is nothing paradoxical in this thought. Myth brings scale to the narratives that stir the human imagination. Old Marduk, whose loss to the pantheon is not particularly to be lamented, did make one pleasing proof of his standing among the gods of Babylon, who did not at first accept his claim to supremacy. He flung a constellation into being, then made it vanish, then restored it. He did other things less beautiful, which nevertheless yielded Tigris and Euphrates, heaven and earth. The heavens for most of us now are a kind of wearying, ethereal sea that accommodates travel from one coast or continent to another. Its vastness and even its turbulence largely forgettable with good earphones and a movie. Or it is the dumping ground, so to speak, of far more detritus than even its great volume can dilute. We keep an eye on it now to gauge its health, speculating nothing, concluding nothing about humankind from our from our epic power to decreate. Properly speaking, we are the stuff of myth, and yet we have no language to address the scale of the experience we have, not only as dwellers in a cosmos, but also as creatures whose thoughts naturally inhabit the vastnesses of myth, creation to doomsday, who see our galaxy as a path across the heavens, who spin out new tales of the impossible even while we sleep. A splendid dignity is spread out over all this, whether recognized or not, by the divine, the good and glorious creator and center and substance of it all. The brain is wider than the sky, said Emily Dickinson. We should grant that this is true, a fact thoroughly demonstrated by us after our fashion and by the ancients after theirs. We should recognize that the scale given to reality by what we call myth is uniquely suited in its hyperbolic grandeur to human habitation. If we are frightened by the hubris that may be reflected in this claim, we can humble ourselves with the thought that we have been foolish enough to deny this luminous vastness to ourselves and to one another. Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming out to sit, learn, and really feel the love that came from those pages. We are going to enter a time now where Harvard Bookstore is going to provide us an opportunity to purchase Marilynne Robinson's work. And she actually has signed many copies and will sign a few copies. So as I say thank you for coming to join us for this year's 2006 William Belden Noble Lecture, I would like to invite a representative from Harvard Bookstore to come forward to offer us a few directions. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.